page 9, second paragraph, or the first paragraph actually, it says, all you do is a bidding, he will never fail you. Why not do this and be an altogether and typical apostolic believer filled with the Holy Spirit? Why be a apostolic in name only, but a Gentile in heart and faith? Work no longer for self. Work for the Yahweh, and be free of the worry, free of having to make your own living in your own way. For the fishermen of the Galilee, while fishing in their own way, failed. But when they cast the net, where Yahshua said that they should cast it, it was instantly filled with the fish. Know first that Yahweh is not interested in your selfish business, but in you and his saving business. There is therefore no need of you serving mammon, self, and at the same time expecting his blessing on mammon's interest. No man, even in the world, can work for his own interest and still expect his firm to promise him or keep him at any post of duty. No employer hires persons because he wants his employees to make a living, but only because he wants his own business cared for. Know that the Yahweh's business is of a greater importance and of a further reaching consequences than any man's business, and that Yahweh is more particular than any man ever was or ever will be. Matthew 11:28-30. Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and you shall find rest unto your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Always remember that Yahweh has not called you to your post of the duty in order to feed you or to make you rich, but to save you and to save others through you. Therefore, whatever you do, do it for the glory of Yahweh. Then and then only will he provide all these things, the things Yahweh sees fit to give. He will see that you earn your needs one way or another, nothing less than the faith of the Noah, of the Job, and of the Daniel will pay the bill. Brother, sister, because any thing short of this is insulting to Yahweh. It is the same as to call him a deceiver. Doubt in the promises of Yahweh completely robs the doubter of all Yahweh's blessings and promises. Only when you learn to trust him will he be to you as a hiding place from the wind, and a covert from the tempest, as the rivers of the water in a dry place, as the shadow of a great rock in a weary land, Isaiah 32:2. Seek ye first the kingdom of Yahweh and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. This promise held good in David's time, and it will hold good now. Psalms 4:5. Offer the sacrifice of righteousness, and put your trust in the Yeshua. My personal experience, David knew Yahweh's faithfulness, having done all that was to be done in the serving Yahweh. He was confident that when the bear and the lion came to devour his lambs, Yahweh would deliver him if he did all he could to spare them. Moreover, believing that Yahweh had promised the kingdom unto him, and having been anointed to be king over Yahweh's people, David doubted nothing. Recognizing his duty, he fearlessly went after the giant Goliath, who was to find Yahweh and his kingdom. And he was confident that the giant could not harm him. By the faith, he freed his people from the power of the giant. By the faith, he overcame the lion and the bear and saved the lamb. By faith, he knew that Saul could not take his life nor deprive him of the throne. No, there is not a beast nor man that can take your life or cheat you of the promotion if you do Yahweh's bidding, if you know that he who keepeth Israel neither sleeps nor slumbers, Psalms 121:3-4, that he knows all about you, my friend, every moment of the day and of the night, that he takes notice even of the hairs that fall from your head, that whatever befalls you is but Yahweh's own will for your own good. I say, if you know and believe that he is the Yahweh and the keeper of your bodies and souls, then regardless what befalls you, you will be happy in it and give Yahweh the credit for it, not murmuring, but glorying even in your trials and afflictions. Isaiah 26:4. Trust ye in the Yahweh forever, for in the Yahweh is everlasting strength. If you wholeheartedly trust in the Yahweh, and if the world should fall into space and collide with the stars, you shall happily fly along with the Yahweh. Let us now turn to 2 Corinthians, the first chapter, and see what Paul knew by the experience about the Yahweh's care over him. 2 Chronicles, 1:8-9. For we would not, brethren, have you ignorant of our trouble which came unto us in Asia, that we were pressed out of measure. That's in 2 Corinthians 2:8-9. Above strength, insomuch that we despaired even of life, that we had this sentence of death in ourselves, that we should not trust in ourselves, but in the Yahweh which we raises the dead. Paul learned by the personal experience that it is futile to trust in man and self, but that it pays high to trust in Yahweh, that he alone is able to protect and keep both body and soul. Psalms 127:1. Except the Yahshua build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Except the Yahshua keep the city, the watchman waketh but in vain. Okay. Many of the Yahweh's faithful people had the same experience as Paul. Time, however, will not permit me to speak of them more than a few. When we enter into the belief which the Bible recommends, then we are ready to enter into the experience which Yahweh wants us personally to be in, which after all counts most to us. Let me first give you my own as a concrete example of what Yahweh does when we let him. While running a small hotel in the middle West back in 1919, I became intensely interested in religion and providentially joined the Seventh-day Adventist Church, for they were at the time meeting in a rented hall, not too attractive for a church, for the people appeared to be very poor. Aside from the preacher, I was the only one that was driving a car, and he had a worn-out Ford that I would not have given a dollar for it if I had to drive it. Imagine now what went through my mind, and you may know that I joined the church only for the truth's sake. Indeed, I had no other encouragement. My hopes of getting rich someday became a nightmare of getting poor. Yes, the devil gave me as good a picture of poverty as he gave a picture of the glory of the kingdom. I nevertheless resolved to stay about the truth I had learned regardless of what happened. Then the time came that I sold the hotel and accidentally got into a grocery business. But after a time I found that I did not want to be in it, and I sold it at a loss. Then that dark and gloomy picture of coming poverty enlarged itself 100-fold. But I did my best to keep happy in the Yahweh. Sometime after I had disposed of the grocery store, I left the city, and 6 months later I landed in California. There I kept sick, and after doing all I knew what to do, one of the retired Seventh-day Adventist ministers that lived in the same place where I was living said, "Let me take you to the Glendale Sanitarium, and I will recommend you as of the good and regular standing with the church, and they will give you good service and a lower rate, too." When we got to the desk, and after the minister told him all he had to say, the sanitarium clerk asked me what kind of a deposit I could leave for admission. I said a check. The sum which surprised me, for I had been in a hospital before, but was never asked to pay anything in advance. No, not even when I was dismissed. They sent me the bill by mail when he saw that the check was drawn on an Illinois bank. I had to explain that I was somewhat new in the West and had not yet transferred my bank account. The clerk reluctantly took the check, and I was assigned to a room and politely told that I had to wait for the doctor until he should come around. Well, I waited all that day, but now the soul came in the evening. As sick as I was, I put on my clothes and went for supper and to the dining room. Then I was told that the doctor was away, but he would see me just as soon as he came back. For 4 days, this went on. Another soul came into my room. I could have died and no one would have known it until perhaps days after. I suppose they had to get the money from the bank and find out if my credit was good before they would give me service. Finally, on the fourth day, the sanitarium chaplain came with the apologies for his delay to see me. If I had known that you were a Seventh-day Adventist, he explained, I would have seen you sooner. I was not expecting him, though, and it did not make much difference with me, but I said to myself, if you did not know what I was, you should have come sooner. At last, the doctor came, and after a thorough examination, I was told that I was a very sick man and had to have a special day and night nurse to look after me and to give me the hydrotherapy treatment. With my consent, a student, a nurse came in, but when the shadows of the evening stretched over the sky, the nurse told me that they were short of special nurses, and so he himself was to wait on me all through the night if I let him move his cot into my room. All the time I was there, though, he never once got up at night to wait on me. And thus I had a private day and night nurse, and in the end I was charged at 50 cents an hour, $6 a day for him to wait on me during the daytime, and $6 nightly for sleeping with me in the room. This alone, with the additional charges, was a heavy drain on my already dwindling savings. And the picture of going broke and of staying poor grew larger and larger in my own mind, but I recovered from my illness and was thankful for this sanitarium incident, though, produced another disappointing picture in my mind. Is that sanitarium Yahweh's place for his sick people? I asked myself, is this people really Yahweh's people? The answer that came to these questions was this: the sanitarium is Yahweh's and the church is Yahweh's, but the people that are running them are reactionaries. They are the modern priests, scribes, and Pharisees. That there is a need for more Samaritans, or more Samaritans among them. This is where Yahweh's truth is though, and now it's helping me, I said, I shall stay with it. Yes, Yahweh did help me. I kept the faith, complained about the nothing, and stood, complained about nothing, and stayed in the church with as good a record as anything. After I left the hospital, however, I was weak and my bank account was almost depleted. It appeared to me, too, that there was nothing that I could get into with the Sabbath off that I would fall to the mercy of some charity or else starve. Moreover, for the several months I had sent neither tithes nor my pledges of offering to the church in the Middle West. Consequently, I owed something like $75. I thought then that if I should fail to pay this debt now, while I had enough to pay it, I could never again get that much money together, and it would have to stay unpaid forever. Better get broke now, I said, and be free of the debt than to get broke later and be in a debtor forever. My bank account, I figured, was just a little over my debt when I wrote a check for the whole balance and sent it to the church in the Middle West. I was left with $3.50 in my pocket and with no prospect of a job. Then I wrote to the bank in the Middle West that I was frozen my account and that they should send the cancel checks and other papers to my address in California. At this point of my life, though, the table turned around as much as it turned with Abraham after he had done all but slay his son Isaac on the altar of Yahweh. Just a few days after I had written to the bank, I heard from them, and to my great surprise, they had enclosed a check to about $350 as my final balance. I never discovered how it happened. In the meantime, I got a job at a washing machine agency, and just then, the Seventh-day Adventists were having their 1923 camp meeting in Los Angeles, and so I decided to attend, and between the meetings, to try to sell Maytag washers in the neighborhood. And what do you suppose? I sold a washer a day and a few vacuum cleaners on the side. Then it went on all the while the camp lasted. And my first check from the company was about $425. But this is not all. Just then, another surprise overtook me. Some years before, I had bought a stock which I had made up my mind was worth it. But to my surprise, I received a letter in which the corporation inquired if I would like to sell it back to them. And the price they offered was more than double the price which I had paid. So here I had a real experience all of my own as promised in Malachi 3:10. Moreover, this Maytag agency was new, and when I went to work for them, they had but a small place. All the while I worked for them, though, they prospered and grew, as did Laban, while Jacob worked for him. In 3 years' time, they opened branch offices all over the vicinity of Los Angeles and then erected a building of their own, which looked like a bank inside now, one block deep and something like 60 feet wide. And as to how their prosperity ended, I will tell you a little later. My unexpected success in the selling the washing machine was used as a boost pump for the other salesman, and the sales manager became very inquisitive about my religion. The last I talked with him, he said to me, "Holly, it must be wonderful to believe as you do, but you know, I could never be a Seventh-day Adventist." I then asked him why he could not be, and he replied, "Because if I begin to keep the Sabbath as you do, I will lose my job." I said, "It is better to lose your job than to lose your life." And the conversation ended. But the next time I went into the office, I saw a wreath hanging on the door, and everything seemed to be upset. Then I was told that Mr. Harney, the sales manager, had suddenly taken sick the night before and died early that morning. About that time, the head bookkeeper too became interested in discussing religion with me. As time went on, I discussed the same I had discussed Mr. Harney, and at last he too said, "Holly, it must be wonderful to feel as you do, but I can never be a Seventh-day Adventist." I said, "Why?" "Oh, I could not keep the Sabbath and my job too," he recalled. "Well," I said, "it is better to lose your job than to lose your life, Mr. Barber." And surely enough, the next time I went into the office, I found everybody talking instead of working. Then I said, and I told that, I was told that Mr. Barber, the head bookkeeper, was found dead that morning in his room. Believe it or not, but this is what happened with both men after they sold their conviction for the price of a job. A little later, I thought that I should have something of my own instead of continuing to work for Mr. Schluter, so I was spending most of my time with the experiments on the health suite, and as I then sold a washer on it now and then, I was not too popular with the company, and as the company owed me some commissions, I decided to find out why were they held back. After discussing the matter several times with the sales manager, he put me off his time with a promise to see to it. But one day I pressed the matter harder. As a result, he said, "Holly, I am tired with this, and I don't care. You can quit." Next time I went in, I learned that Mr. Lisco, the sales manager, was discharged and that Mr. Foster had taken his post. Mr. Lisco, you see, was the one who had to quit, not I. I then went to see the new manager about my commission. He promised to investigate the matter and to let me know the next time I came in. he though did the same thing Mr. Lisco did, and when I pressed the matter as hard as I did with Mr. Lisco, he too said, "Holly, I am tired with the thing and do not care if you quit, particularly in that though." The next time I went in, I was told that Mr. Foster, the sales manager, was discharged and was no longer with the company. I still was. By the time I had created enough business with my health suits to keep busy, and was about to quit altogether, I then went to see Mr. Sluter himself about the aforementioned commission, but he received me very coldly and plainly told me that I had nothing coming. I quit, but in the space of less than about 6 months, I think it was, he lost the agency, and another man took over the company. This is the way his prosperity ended. Not long after I had gone to work for this company and while canvassing, I met a woman whose husband was of the Jewish descent, but she was a Scandinavian and a Seventh-day Adventist. She told me that her husband was terribly opposed to her religion, and at one time he threw her Bible into the stove. She wished I could in some way help her husband change his attitude. I asked her to tell him that I would like to see him in his home the following night. She promised to try it and then to let me know. And he sat down to several studies. He sat down to several studies with me in his home with the family present. I was surprised, though, to find him very agreeable to what was presented, altogether contrary to what his wife had told me after I had given him three studies. He called me aside, pulled his pants pocket inside out, and said to me, "You see, I have a big family to feed, and only 3 cents in my pocket. Before you came to me, I did everything to get a job, but failed. In my distress," he continued, "I prayed for the first time in my life. I asked Delbert to send someone to show me what to do. When I heard you were coming," he added, "I thought it was an answer to my prayer, and I was anxious to meet you. And that is why you found me so open-minded to your religion. But now," he said, "I know that Yahweh sent you." I asked him if he would like to sell washing machines, and he replied, "I am ready to do anything you suggest." I took him to the company I was working for, and he went to work immediately, trucking with his own pickup, his wages and a few sales occasionally brought him over $200 monthly. He owned the house he was living in, and his living was not so high in those days. He was able to save a good share of his wages. After time, he sold his house, bought a 5-acre plot, and built a new house and a good poultry shed on the plot. Then he told me that he intended to work for the company about 18 months longer, and by that time he would have his house and land all clear, or somewhat to her, and then he could make a good living on his 5-acre plot. Well, it all looked fine. But one Sabbath morning he met me in church and told me that the company was to be taken over that day. He wanted to know if I would go with him and listen to the speeches while the transfer was being made. I reasoned with him that it was not the place to spend the Sabbath in, but he argued that if he were not present, they might hire another man in his place, and he could not afford to lose his job. He therefore attended the business meeting. Shortly after, though, the new company discharged him. Consequently, he could not keep the payments on the property, and the trust company foreclosed on it. Then his wife died. Anyone can see that all these sequential events of the day closely tied one to another with nothing else in between could not possibly have been accidental, but strictly providential. Now let me relate to you another miracle that took place about that time. One Wednesday, I drove to the business section of the Los Angeles Heaven. Finished my business quite late in the afternoon, and while walking across the street, I saw a woman driving toward me. But as I was almost to the middle of the street, I saw no danger, for there was plenty of room for her to drive by. She nevertheless turned her car right square into me. Yes, she struck me from my left, and being overly excited, she could not stop her car before she reached the middle of the block, and so she kept on going from the corner of the street to the middle of the alley. What happened to me when the car struck me? Did it lay me flat on the street? And did it run over me? No, this did not happen, because something greater took place. An unseen hand carried me on ahead of the car, lightly sliding my feet on the pavement. With my right side ahead and my left side against the car's radiator, after having made about half the distance before the car stopped, something seated me on the bumper of the car, and I put my left arm around the car's left headlight, and I said to myself, "Now, lady, you can keep on going if that is the best you can do." When she stopped, I put my feet on the ground and stepped away from the car. Just then I discovered that the pencil I had in my coat pocket had broken into a half a dozen pieces from the impact, but my ribs were untouched. By that time, the car and I were surrounded with the people and 3 policemen, something for the man that got run over. But as they found, they were searching for the man that had gotten run over, but as they found no one lying on the street or pinned under the car, I told them that it was me, because I who had been run over. They wanted to take me to the hospital, and I told them that I was not hurt. I heard one say, you must be hurt, but it's too excited and does not know his condition. Then they made me raise my legs and arms up and down several times, after which one shouted, "He is made out of rubber." the woman was actually accused of driving at 30 miles per hour, and I walked 3 blocks to my car and drove to prayer meeting in Exposition Park Church, where in a season of the testimonies I told them of the accident and the results. We are still living in the days of the miracles, you see. After all these and other experiences, then came the message which we are now endeavoring to take to the latest end. The enemies of the message then left nothing unturned in their search for the something against me. The message then. They left nothing unturned in their search for something against me, rather than to make sure that they were not turning down truth. They tried every hook and a crook to pin something on me and to stop my activity. They found nothing, and as a rule, about 30 members of the church stayed in my special meeting each Sabbath afternoon. Then came the time that the elders of the church refused to let us use the church for our meeting, and they made us all get out. But one of the sisters who was living in a big house right across from the church offered her place for the meeting, and there was a great uproar among the people around the church premises. Some were for us and some were against us, so it was that the house across from the church was filled that afternoon, and many listened from the outside through the windows. The enemies failed to break up our meeting, and the victory was ours. Next, they forbade us to attend their church services, and they began to disfellowship those who still wanted to attend our meeting. They tried to deport me also, but failed. Then they endeavored to get a court order against any of us going to the church on the Sabbath, but lost out. Once they called the police to have me arrested on the false charges that I was disturbing the meeting, but after the officers in the police station heard my story and the deacon's charges against me, he commanded the two policemen who brought us to the station to put us in their car again and to take us right back to the church where they picked me up. After this, the elders endeavored to put me in an insane asylum for the city manager of the Glendale himself, a Seventh-day Adventist, had come to this church that Sabbath morning to lay down the charges and to see me carried away and locked in the asylum. After talking with me for a few minutes, though, officer did nothing but to tell me that he would not bother me again. Then the 200-pound city manager felt smaller than my 135-pound weight. They did all these unbecoming things and many others besides. They talked and preached against me, and though I had no one but the Yahweh to defend me at any time, yet in all these the victory was mine. When we moved our office from California to Texas, where we had nothing, and neither friend nor believer in the message, the church elders were glad and thought our work would then die out for sure. It nevertheless grew more than before, although this took place in the midst of the Depression in 1935, while hundreds and thousands of businesses were going bankrupt, and while well-to-do men were becoming poor. Yet we who started out with nothing grew and prospered. We moreover never took collections in any of our meetings anywhere and never made any calls for money. This holds good still until our free life, our free literature that goes out week by week amounts to hundreds and thousands of dollars week to week. And yet after year, besides the cost of building the institution, and today after going through the nightmare of supposing I might live a life of poverty, as I explained before, my credit is unlimited, and the checks I write amount after thousands of dollars week after week and year after year. Although I am not bonded, even no property, I own no property and have no personal bank account. Furthermore, I pay my secretaries as much as I pay myself, and some of my workmen I pay twice as much. Yes, there are as great miracles today as there ever were. Jacob, too, had no righteousness of his own, but he had a great zeal and respect for the righteousness of the Yeshua. Esau, though, who had no regard for the righteousness of the Yeshua, sold his birthright only for a mess of pottage. What a bargain was Jacob. As a result, though, Jacob became a fugitive the first night away from home. However, Yahweh met him, and having given him a vision, Jacob put his whole trust in Yahweh and pledged to be faithful in all his duties. To start with, in Padan-Aram, Jacob had nothing but faith and zeal. For he was only a good workman, and that is all. These are qualities Laban immediately recognized in Jacob, and as a result, Laban not only offered to give Jacob his daughter, Rachel, for a wife, but even devised a scheme by which to force him to take both daughters, Rachel and Leah, as the only girls in the family, moreover, although Jacob dearly paid for them with the 14 solid years of hard, faithful labor, he in the next 6 years became rich. Then, on returning home, he wholeheartedly, honestly, and with free conscience, said to Laban, "This 20 years have I been with thee, thy ewes and thy she-goats have not cast so young, and the rams of thy flock have I not eaten." Genesis 31:38. Still further, when he was asked what he wanted for his work after the 14 years were over, he chose the wages Yahweh would pay, not Laban. For he said to Laban, "Thou shalt not give me anything, but let me pass through all thy flock today, and remove from thence all the speckled, spotted, and brown cattle, sheep and goats, and take them 3 days' journey apart from the rest, so that there be no chance for them getting mixed. Today, all the sheep and cattle, speckled or unspeckled, are to be yours. But hereafter, all the speckled that shall be born from among the unspeckled, the apparently impossible, shall be mine for serving thee." Laban was well pleased with the contract, and Jacob went to work. Yahweh blessed Jacob's labor in spite of the natural impossibility, and within 6 years, he became rich. Why? Because Jacob served Yahweh wholeheartedly and implicitly trusted in him for his living. He wanted nothing but what Yahweh would let him have. For he knew that so long as he worked for the Yahweh would leave him neither hungry nor naked. He knew that if Yahweh so clothed the grass of the field, he would clothe and feed him in his vineyard. Since Jacob was getting rich so fast, and since his father-in-law wanted him to stay longer, and also since Jacob still feared Esau, why did he leave Laban, and why did he start for home? Well, the answer is simple. Because Yahweh asked him to say, Genesis 31:13, "I am the Yahweh of the vessel, where thou anointest the pillar, and where thou vowest a vow unto me. Now arise, get thee out from this land, and return unto the land of thy kindred." From this record you see Jacob was faithful at his post of the duty, and always mindful of the Yahweh's command. Are we like Jacob, or are we like Judas? Iscariot. For the Jacob now, you know, took perfect care of the Laban's business, and followed Yahweh's directions all the way. But Judas, his Iscariot, took perfect care of his own selfish interest at the expense of Yahweh's gifts, and rather than following the Yeshua's direction, he followed his own. Now though, comparing Jacob and with that of Judas, one's work ended in glory, and the other's work ended in shame and disaster. For whom are you working, brother, sister? For yourself or for Yahweh? You say for Yahweh, and I hope you are right, but remember, as I said before, that no business firm will promote a workman that is not interested at last as much in the prosperity of his firm as he is in the size of his wages. Moreover, no firm is interested in the workman's private business. It is interested in his own business. For the Yahweh's business, though, is far more important and of far greater consequence than the business of any man. He too is not at all interested in your selfish business. He is interested in his business of the saving souls, for you cannot therefore make your own interest at first important and his of second, and at the same time expect to reap his promises and expect him to answer your prayers. If such be the case, then you are even fairly calling yourself a Christian. According to Matthew 6:32, you are still a deluded Gentile. To be a Christian in the obvious sight, you must never praise yourself, but praise Yahweh and His goodness. Never boast of your own interest and achievement, but boast of the Yahweh's. Never try to promote your business, but always try to promote Yahweh. Never pray for light to know what to do and where to go in order that your business, your interests prosper, but rather pray for the light that Yahweh help you do the thing or go to the place where you would best serve His cause, that He leads you and teach you how to advance His kingdom. Then and then only will you find that you never go wrong. Any motive other than this will take you where Yahweh does not want you, and where you will have to carry your own burden independent of Him. Okay, I have seen a number of individuals swear by the heaven and earth that Yahweh has led them here or there and to this or into the other. But when things did not please them, then they packed away swearing just as hard that Yahweh had not led them into the thing, and again swear just as hard as before that Yahweh is taking them out of it and into something better. They again felt just as harshly that Yahweh was leading in their move, though it was the opposite of what they thought He had led them in before. Others had felt that Yahweh had opened the way for them to do this or the other by the fact that they had been able to get the money for the trip or to buy a buyer for one thing or another, to have this and to have that. Still, others told me that they opened the Bible at random and that their eyes dropped on a verse which indicated Yahweh's approval of their move. One brother told me that he had flipped a coin, and another had found an Indian arrow pointing in the direction he should go. All these I have seen come to this. Now, although these indications were held as positive evidence of the Yahweh's will and the matters under the question, let me now tell you that these indications in themselves are but presumption of the highest form, hallucination and gambling, not Yahweh's signs at all. Moreover, anyone plans which are based on purely selfish interest, based purely on where and how one may better his private profit-making projects, while he professes to be a Christian, I tell you that all of these are schemes. not Yahweh's plans at all, regardless how the way opens or what happens. The fact is that Yahweh is never given opportunity to direct in these things. For to give him the opportunity, he said, "Seek ye first the kingdom of Yahweh and his righteousness, and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. When you therefore make the kingdom of the Yahweh your chief interest, then you will most surely find yourself in the right place at the right time, doing the right thing and reaping Yahweh's richest blessing. You can then rest assured that He will open the way and take you where you need to be, even if He has to lift you out of the well and to tell the Ishmaelites to carry you into Egypt and to put you working in the Potiphar's house. He may even have to take you into prison before He seats you with the Pharaoh on the throne. Or He may cause you to run away from Egypt and have you keep sheep for 40 years at Mount Horeb. He may bring you against the Red Sea while the Egyptians are pursuing you. He may bring you into the desert where there is neither water nor food, for the lion and the bear may come to take your land, for the Goliath to kill your people, and the king may cast you in the fiery furnace or in the lion's den. Yes, hundreds and thousands of things may happen, but he that trusts in the Yahweh and does his work well shall find all these so-called hindrances or mishaps wonderful deliverances and avenues to success, all carrying out the Yahweh's marvelous plan and Yahweh's way towards your promotion from one great thing to another. When you are in the Yahweh's care and in His control, never say the devil did this or that, regardless what it be, for he can do nothing except he is allowed to do it. Always give Yahweh the credit. I came to America not because I wanted to, but because Yahweh wanted me to. And since I knew not my future work, and as Yahweh could then no more make me understand than he could at first make Joseph understand his trip to Egypt, I was therefore driven out of the country at the point of a gun, as was Moses driven out of Egypt, although I had done nothing to bring trouble upon myself. And who do you suppose the rebels to storm me out of the country? And who do you suppose led the rebels to storm me out of the country? Question mark. None other but the Greek Orthodox bishop of the province. And where do you suppose he sponsored his pursuing campaign? In the church on the Sunday morning, while in his full regalia and about 20 feet from where I stood. At that time, I knew not what my going away from home to such a distant land was about, but now I know, as well as Joseph knew, that his brethren's hope to defeat Yahweh's plan for him was but Yahweh's plan to get him down into the Egypt, and so rather than to thwart the plan, they really caused the plan to be carried out. When things go contrary to one's will and way today, most Christians give credit to the devil. Only when things go according unto their liking do they give credit to the Yahweh's Balaam too, was happy when the way opened for him to go to Balak. But when the angel of the Yahweh blocked the road he was traveling on, then Balaam became as mad as a dog and smote the ass. No, nothing but you yourself can defeat Yahweh's plans for you. Be it your friends or your enemies, be it beasts or kings, you will find them all unwittingly or wittingly working for your good rather than for your harm if you are doing Yahweh's bidding. What a rich resource heaven is, and who knows it. Remember now that whatever may stand in your way, be it the Red Sea or the River Jordan, be it a mountain or be it a desert, it shall become your very stepping stone. Such as this is the righteousness of the Yeshua, and you can have it at the cost of your own righteousness, then you will find the Yeshua's way as much higher than yours as the heaven is higher than the earth. When this happens, then only you will understandingly say the Yeshua of righteousness. Thou will keep him in the perfect peace whose mind is stayed on thee, because he trusts in thee, trusts you in the Yahshua forever, for in the Yahshua is in the Yahweh the, and Yahshua's Son is the everlasting strength, for he bringeth down them that dwell on high, the lofty city, he layeth it low. He layeth it low even to the ground. He bringeth it even to the dust. The foot shall tread it down, even the feet of the poor, and the steps of the needy, Isaiah 26:3-6. This brings in verse 10. This is our contact. This is the 11th hour call.